House State Affairs is called to order. It's 9:04 a.m. It's February the 28th. We do have a quorum to conduct business consisting of Senator French, Bundy, and myself, McGuire. We had scheduled three items on the agenda. One of them, Senate Bill 208, Sex Offenses Without Consent Definition by Senator Dyson, has been postponed at the request of the bill sponsor. So we'll take up SJR 12 first, cruise ship port times and the Jones Act, and then go to Senate Bill 276, State Construction Project Labor Agreements. Good morning, Senator Terrio.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Before you in your packet, you should have a blank CS for the resolution. It would be /E, and if that's what we could have before us for discussion this morning, I'd appreciate that.
May I have a motion for that?
The blank CS, /echo.
Okay. Is there an objection to having E before us? Okay, so we have it before us.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. SJR 12 would put the state legislature on record as opposing the proposed changes to the interpretation of the Passenger Vessel Service Act of June 19, 1886 by the United States Department of Homeland Security, Bureau of Customs and Border Protection, which would affect the cruise itineraries of foreign flag vessels transporting passengers to ports in the state of Alaska. In November, the United States Department of Homeland Security, Bureau of Customs and Border Protection published a new interpretation of the Passenger Vessel Service Act of 1886. This new interpretation will require all foreign flag cruise ships to, one, spend at least 48 hours in a foreign port, spend at least 50% of the time at U.S. ports to be spent in foreign ports, and also require that passengers depart in a foreign port. This has a tremendous, tremendous impact on the cruise ship business that comes to the state of Alaska. The industry brings upward of 1 million passengers to Alaska each year. The result with this new interpretation would mean that approximately 158 fewer voyages and approximately 349,000 fewer passengers will visit Alaska, which would bring a resulting loss in potential revenue of $222 million. That goes to support the Alaskan businesses here in the state, not only along the coast, but of course those cruise ships bring a number of passengers that can then continue to travel inland. We have a number of people here from state agencies, also from the industry, to testify. I do want to make you aware that the public comment period for comment on this interpretation, this new interpretation, has closed. So we will not be making a statement that will be officially entered into the public comment gathering. However, a decision has not been rendered, and I still think there's an opportunity for the legislature on behalf of the industry and those people involved in employment with the cruise ship industry to make a statement on behalf of the state and how we think, what we think about the new interpretation. The language in the blank committee substitute makes a couple of changes to make it clear that we oppose the new interpretation. However, if that interpretation is adopted, we're asking for an exemption for the state of Alaska. And with that, I'm available to answer questions, or as I indicated, there are other individuals here that might have a level of expertise to answer particular questions.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Senator Terrio? Senator Bundy.
Did I read in the, thank you, read in the paper somewhere that this interpretation was brought into effect by some problems with cruise ships going to Hawaii and folks upset with basically foreign flag competition, and where they were, these ships were temporarily docking in Mexican waters for a few hours and then going on to Hawaii. Is that the genesis of this interpretation?
Yes, Senator, through the chair. It really does, the new interpretation does spring from a problem that arose in Hawaii, where you had ships that served the Hawaiian market in between the islands that were American flagged vessels. And then over time, the cruise ships, a lot of the large cruise ships that seasonally come to the state of Alaska, some of them were going from the west coast over to Hawaii, around the islands, and then to avoid the problem with the old ruling. They would then go to Mexico, touch base at a port there overnight, and then go back to the West Coast. And so that's what's triggered this. In the Federal Register, just reading through the determination, it talks about the Hawaiian market, the Hawaiian market, the Hawaiian market. And right at the very end, it says, accordingly, CBP proposes to adopt an interpretation rules under which it will presume that any cruise itinerary that does not include a foreign port of call would be determined to be in violation. So they address just the Hawaiian issue, but at the very end, they sweep all cruise ships in with that wording, and that's what's created the problem.
Thank you.
Questions for Senator Terrio? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We do have folks here to testify on the bill. Wayne Stevens with the State Chamber. Good morning and welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Wayne Stevens. I'm President and CEO of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. The Board of Directors of the Alaska State Chamber support passage of SJR 12. State Chamber is on record opposing the proposed U.S. Customs and Border Protection criteria to determine if foreign flag passenger vessels are in violation of the Passenger Service Vessels Act. While intended to solve a problem in Hawaii, the proposed interpretation of regulations does not specifically limit the requirements to Hawaii cruises from U.S. ports. The requirements for cruise ships to stop at foreign ports appear to cover any voyages and could be interpreted to impact round-trip voyages to Alaska from Seattle, Washington. Approximately 158 voyages and some 349,000 passengers could be affected by the new Customs Border Protection proposed changes in regulations. This is roughly one-third of the cruise passengers coming to Alaska. The voyages impacted are those cruises beginning and ending in Seattle or San Francisco. On a seven-day itinerary, considering the distances to port in southeast Alaska from Seattle, it is only possible to have one port call in southeast and still not meet the three proposed criteria. This will not affect ships originating or concluding their voyage in a foreign port, such as Vancouver, BC. The loss of business in Alaskan ports would be devastating to our communities and delicate economy. This interpretation could be in effect for the 2008 summer season. The loss of jobs, businesses, revenue, and taxes would be crippling to the state. If cruise ships were required to make foreign port calls of 48 hours and to spend 50% of port time in foreign ports on round-trip voyages from Seattle to Alaska, it would make the existing seven-day itineraries impossible to operate. The only alternative would be for ships to spend less time in Alaska ports and more time in Canadian ports. Clearly, this would harm Alaska. The proposed changes to regulations appear to be a significant departure from industry practice, not an interpretation of existing regulations. No ships call in Alaska or Canadian ports for 48 hours. These proposed changes will not only affect coastal Alaska, but all communities involved in the visitor industry will feel the impact. Cruise ship passengers typically fly into or out of Alaska to connect to cruise itineraries or at the end of those cruise trips. The solution to a problem in Hawaii will have a significant detrimental impact to Alaska and its cruise industry. The Board of Directors of the Alaska State Chamber urges adoption of SJR 12. Thank you for your consideration and thoughtful deliberations.
Thank you. And I have a question, and then Senator Bundy. What efforts is the Chamber doing nationally to influence the reg writers and lawmakers in Washington, D.C., since that's really where the decision is going to be?
We have commented, and it's my understanding there has been an abundance of comments on this particular rulemaking process, all generally opposed to the proposed, to the regulations as proposed.
Do you have any hope that you'll be successful?
I think everyone has hope, or you wouldn't get up in the morning.
Does it look promising?
It's my understanding that there is potential to get this overturned.
Okay.
Or set aside.
I just wondered the likelihood. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. My question was related to yours. Obviously,
if this stayed in effect, Seattle would lose substantial business because I suspect they'd, mm-hmm. Port of Call would simply move to Vancouver. Is the state of Washington and Seattle doing something to encourage and overturn this?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, it's my understanding that the port groups in Seattle and Tacoma and visitor companies and industries in the state of Washington and elsewhere are commenting on this as well.
Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Stevens? Thank you for being here on behalf of the chamber.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, next we have Ron Peck, I think, with ATIA or someone from ATIA. There we go. You could just put your name on the record.
For the record, my name is Jeremy Geezer, and I am the Juneau Chapter President of the Alaska Travel Industry Association, and I was asked to come by today and kind of give you our 2 cents worth. I also work for Gastineau Guiding, which is a local tour company here in town, as a manager for them. Pretty much, you know, I can't speak beyond my scope of understanding with this, but what I do understand is that if we lose up to a third of the port calls here in Juneau, the business I work for is going to not be able to hire as many seasonal workers. And there are some companies like mine that are just small enough, when you lose a third of your business, you're going to lose some of the year-round jobs that you can provide for people. So that's frustrating, because all of those jobs and opportunities are going to go to British Columbia, ports like Prince Rupert, Victoria, and I don't think we definitely don't want to see that. I hope that it's group here today would agree with that. But the proposed interpretation would have not only a devastating impact on our business, but also on the other communities in Alaska, on all visitor services, on many direct and indirect Alaska businesses that depend on the economy generated by this industry. Each of these organizations stands to suffer significant economic hardships with the acceptance of the proposed interpretation. And by moving this resolution forward, you are sending an important message and supporting the viability of our state. So I just want to thank you and hope that you kind of will support us in this. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions? Okay. Next, I have Chip Toma.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Chip Toma, box 21884 here in Juneau. I just wanted to, again, bring it to the committee's attention, as the gentleman from the state chamber did, that all the cruises that emanate from Vancouver are legal, and it's only the Seattle cruises, which is about half of the trade these days, that is illegal under the Passenger Services Act. And, of course, the complication can be solved by Vancouver building a few more dock spaces and then taking over the entire trade and servicing it out of Vancouver. So I think there is a resolve that can be made to it. The problem with the Seattle-based cruises is that once they leave Seattle, they don't spend any time in Canadian waters until they come back. And then they have an 8-hour layover tour, a day tour of Victoria. So they actually tie up at the dock of Victoria. Folks get off and get an 8-hour tour, and then they go back to Seattle where they end the tour. So that's the token stop that's done by the Seattle trade. As Senator Bundy was inquiring, the San Diego trade stops in Ensenada on their way back from Hawaii. And they stop in for about 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the night and tie up. The passengers don't get off there. So I guess in conclusion, I support the resolution. I think the resolution should be more focused. For instance, in line 6 of page 1, instead of saying the cruise ship industry, what we should be saying is the Port of Seattle. That's the real focus here, is the Port of Seattle. It's really not the cruise ship industry on the West Coast, per se, but the Port of Seattle for this purpose. And then on line 8, at the end of cruise ships, you could say cruise ships from Seattle. And in line 10, instead of 1 million passengers, approximately about 500,000 passengers from Seattle. So those are my recommendations, is that we focus the resolution a little bit more and understand that everything out of Vancouver is legal.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Questions? Okay. Next, we have Don Habiger. All the way over in the corner. Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair, Senator, committee members, my name is Don Haberger, and I work for Royal Caribbean and Celebrity Cruises. I'm regional vice president for their company and oversee Alaska and the West Coast for government affairs. You have heard much committee, or testimony rather, in opposition to this regulation by CBP, and the industry also is on record in opposition to these proposed regulations. We use a number of trade organizations to get our message out, and I think the best one is our membership and the comments from the Association of American Port Authority. And they say the rule would drastically restrict vacation options available to cruise passengers. And in that, they specifically mention Alaska. The effect of the rule, as drafted, would be to limit the cruise markets to itineraries to a single U.S. port of call, driving all Alaska business to Canada, Hawaii business to Mexican ports, and eliminating Key West, Florida, and numerous U.S. East Coast and Gulf ports of call. I think it says it very succinctly right there. And I know there is a controversy in the Hawaiian market. We believe from the foreign side of foreign flag side of the industry that we have a different niche in that market. Typically, our cruises to the Hawaiian Islands are 14 and 15 days, and thereby pick up a different clientele than the Hawaiian market U.S. flag traffic over there. They are typically a seven-night inner island only. So we think there is room for us both in Hawaii. We think this interpretation or proposed regulation would drastically change the business in North America, and therefore we oppose it. Thank you.
Okay, questions?
But support the resolution.
Okay. Do you want to leave that with the committee? Is there something in the packet that you want to make part of the record?
I read into it, okay. So you're
great.
Fine.
Great, thank you. Thanks. Very much. Okay, next, Carol McConkey.
I have a question.
Okay, for questions from the Department of Commerce, Economic Development and Commerce. And then Chris Poig from the Department of Law. Any questions for him? Okay, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify this morning on SJR 12? Anyone online that I've overlooked? Okay, so that brings the resolution back before us for committee discussion.
I have a question.
Yes, Senator French.
I just don't know. Maybe someone can tell me, maybe the prime sponsor knows, whether the governor received an answer to her letter that she sent December 20th, 2007.
You know?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Heather Brakes, staff to Senator Terrio. It's my understanding she has not received a formal response. The gentleman from Department of Law may be able to answer that more clearly, but that's my understanding from speaking with her staff just yesterday.
Thank you.
Chris, can you answer that?
No.
Okay. There is officially no answer. Okay. Further questions? Senator Bundy, Senator French? Senator Bundy.
You ready for a motion?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I move that we pass from committee CS for Senate Joint Resolution 12. With individual recommendations.
Okay, is there an objection to moving the Senate joint resolution? Okay, hearing and seeing none, SJR 12 has moved. Thank you, Senator Terrio, and the folks that testified. Okay, next. We have a shrinking calendar.
Yes, we do.
Yes. We waived Senator French's bill. He asked it to be removed. Okay, so we next have Senate Bill 276 and Senator Bundy.
And
tell us about your bill.
If it's all right with you, I would remain here, Madam Chair.
It's just fine.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Before we begin, I do have a CS for you that I would like to move as our working document. It's / Mike Wayne, dated 2206-08.
And that's the M version?
That's the, yes.
Okay, is there an objection to adopting M as our working document? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we have M before us. Senator Bundy.
Madam Chair, I have a fairness issue before you. I'll give you just a little background, a personal experience. I don't think it would be considered a conflict, but I'll give you experience anyway. My mother-in-law, before she passed away, worked as a waitress supporting herself. She was a single mother. And she belonged to some union in Washington State, faithfully paid her dues, admittedly not a large amount of dues, every week out of her tips that she earned as a waitress. Then, being the sweetheart she was, she came to Alaska for about 6 months to be with us when our first child was born. Unbeknownst to her, somewhere in the fine print of her union contract was a proviso about a break in service. So after 20 years of every week paying this union dues, when she retired, she was then found out that there was a proviso about a break in service and never received any benefits after all these years of pain because the break in service. We have something similar going on in Alaska. We have folks that go to work under a project labor agreement. They are not union members. They do not then continue in union service, but they are, under current law, required to pay their employer is required to pay into a union retirement and benefit plan, but these non-union workers never have access to that money. It, of course, is a benefit to the union retirement plan because it gives them funds that will never be drawn on, but it's certainly not fair to the laborers. So what, and I'd like to point out that well, the example I used was a few cents every week out of my mother-in-law's tips. We're now talking about substantial amounts of money. I've heard of an instance where someone had $30,000 or $40,000 worth of benefits. The worker accumulated under the TAPS, Trans-Alaska Pipeline Project. He passed away. His wife went to collect, and sorry, Charlie, you don't get anything because you're not a union member. The projections I've heard under something like the gas line, if and when that happens, would be something like $17 to $20 an hour that the employer would pay into the benefits package. And then if the employee is not a union member, that money is never available to them. Again, that does not seem fair. So what Senate Bill 276 aims to achieve is to suggest that in a project labor agreement, a laborer, an employee, has the option, three options, basically. They can have the benefits paid into the union plan, as does occur under existing law. They can have it paid into their employer at the time benefit plan or another employer that they may have may be working for. So that the upshot is that a non-union employee has their benefits available to them if they are never join the union and are covered by the non-union employer benefit program, retirement program. If indeed at some time they then join the union, of course they have the option of being under the union benefit program and then having their benefits contribution placed into that program. So that's the essence of the bill. There's several people here who would like to testify about it. I just again point out the basic fairness of it allowing workers the option to elect to be covered by the union benefit plan, the employer non-union benefit plan, and in allowing those workers, when they do retire, have access to funds that they thought they were going to have access to.
Okay, questions for the bill sponsor, Senator Bundy? Nope. Okay, the first person I have signed in to testify is Vince Beltrami. Good morning. Welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the State Affairs Committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify on SB 276. My name is Vince Beltrami, and I'm president of the Alaska AFL-CIO. And I applaud Senator Bundy's and Green for seeking to look out for the best interest of all employees who may work under the terms of a project labor agreement. I'm not opposed to the bill, but would like to clarify a few things and hope you'd consider some specific amendments or recommendations before moving the bill along. First of all, the notion that PLAs discriminate against non-union workers, in my experience, is somewhat of a fallacy. I don't mean to disrespect anything that was said, but I could clarify any of this stuff. I'd like to go through my comments first and answer any other questions. Most non-union workers who've gone to work under the terms of a PLA have realized superior benefits that are offered by a joint labor management trust fund. In fact, many of the workers that realize the benefits of PLAs stay on with the unions after the project is completed, once they realize how good the benefits are under the terms of a collective bargaining agreement. And Rep. Mike Kelly, in his press release on the identical companion bill in the House, identified three primary fringe benefits that he said would discriminate against non-union employees working under a PLA: health or medical, training, and pension plans. And contrary to claims that are bandied about by some non-union employers and by Rep. Kelly's press release, the fringe benefit plans that are offered under PLAs do not discriminate against non-union employees. And I'd like to address each one of those in order. On the medical or health plan, these are typically superior plans. Employees become participants as soon as the minimum qualifying requirements have been met, whether they're union or non-union. In a typical labor management sponsored plan, an employee puts in around 300 qualifying hours, usually not more than a month and a half if they're working on a 7-10 schedule, which is something that would happen on a big project like the gas line. And no different than what a longtime union member has to do to qualify. And additionally, unlike typical non-union plans, participants build up an hour bank that can cover them with these real good medical plans for as much as a year after the project is completed, because that hour bank has been built up. And typically, coverage under non-union plans ceases immediately upon the termination of the employee, and so they don't get that extended health benefit. In terms of the training, contributions that make participants eligible to avail themselves of any skill improvement training are available to union members or non-union members if that contribution is being made on their behalf. And that entitles them to things such as OSHA training, HAZWOPER, CPR, first aid, and any other skill-specific upgrade training that many of the union training programs provide. And I really don't know of any comparable training programs that exist in the non-union sector. So the only question that often arises, and which is probably the impetus for the introduction that the Senator Bundy alluded to, is in the context of pension contributions. And I know you're all familiar with defined benefit plans, and universally, defined benefit plans require 5 years of vesting for participants to earn a benefit, not 10 years, which is what it was under TAPS. And this gas line project, at this point, it may not last long enough for a participant to vest if it's less than a five-year project. However, they would vest if the project was longer than that and they worked on it. So accordingly, labor fully expects for the licensee or whomever is negotiating the terms of PLA to bring up alternatives to defined benefits in negotiations. And of course, many of the unions offer both defined benefit and defined contribution plans. And I fully expect that the unions will agree to some sort of a hybrid arrangement that allows fully vested union members to continue with their existing plans, and an option that would allow for something such as what's been suggested in this bill. But the slippery slope, I think, is in oversimplification of this element by a simple declaration of benefits by the employee. The unions will fully agree to allow our benefit plans to be opened up and examined by all parties. The same must be true of any non-union employers who work or come to work on the project and who have some type of fringe benefit plans that they want to have be considered for the project. And our experience has been that some non-union plans have comparable, excellent benefits, but that many do not. And examples of fraudulent or less than acceptable fringe benefit plans are difficult, that are difficult for employees to navigate and oftentimes leave them without the benefits that the employees thought they were getting, have been found time and again when you're looking at Davis-Bacon compliance reviews that I've done previously as a union rep and organizer, and that we've seen in things across the state and across the country. So as it pertains to the choices that are provided under the Declaration of Benefits, I think it's imperative that the benefit options meet the level of scrutiny that the union-sponsored plans are subject to, and they're comparable to the union plans. Not to include that type of provision would be a disservice to the employees and contrary to what it seems the bill is seeking to accomplish. The only other concern I have, and another slippery part of the slope to consider, is the precedent that this type of bill would set. And I've not seen where any other legislative body has set out to legislate things that are always mandatory subjects of collective bargaining. And will the legislature go on to negotiate more terms in other collective bargaining agreements? I don't know that that's a great precedent. But if you move forward in that direction and it does pass legal muster, which I'm not certain that it does, and the legislature wants to get involved in the collective bargaining processes of other bargaining that the state and its entities engage in, it would seem somewhat of a subrogation of the duties currently assigned to others, and a proclamation that the legislature is ready to and willing and able to fill up an already compacted 90-day schedule and take on more than you guys are typically faced with. That said, I'm glad to see the legislators looking out for the best interests of Alaskan employees. I do it every day, and we don't just do it for our members. Our concern and involvement over things like minimum wage, unemployment insurance, and other issues demonstrates that organized labor works hard on issues that do benefit working Alaskans other than our union members. This bill seeks to do something similar, and I urge you to just make sure it protects employees that are not union members to the same level as the union members who will go to work under the terms of a PLA. So again, please consider amending sections 36.30.405B, 1, 2, and 3 to assure that employees will get the same level of benefits as those provided to our typical union members. And then section 36, 30.
Can you go back to that real quickly? So in B, in section 1, B, 1, 2, and 3, what would that be under your theory be changed?
In my, well, I haven't made a specific proposal, but only that it would be to the same level of consideration. That essentially those plans meet the same level of benefits that are required or that exist under those that are offered by the union benefit plans.
Okay. And when you say that, are we, because we talked about health, medical, training, and pension.
Right.
Is it your testimony that you would want all three to be equal?
Well, certainly. Whatever the prevailing wage package would be, it'll have a, you know, part of that is wage and the other part is the fringe benefit. So that fringe benefit needs to be equal, whatever the benefits are, medical, training, pension, some have legal benefits, so that if there's going to be a benefit plan that's approved that's contrary to the union, that it needs to be at least as good, comparable, so that employees that opt for that option have the same amount of coverage on their benefit plans that the typical union member enjoys.
Senator Green.
I think I understand what you're saying, but I don't understand why that would be your concern. If I, as an employee, choose to put my contribution somewhere else, and why you would care?
Well, for the reasons I said, we represent employees, whether they're members of our union or not. And if there are benefit plans, if you're going to go down this slope and try to negotiate benefits that are essentially they're checking off saying we don't want the union benefits, we'll take the non-union benefits. It needs to be comparable. It needs to protect the employee in the same way that our benefits protect the union members. That the pension is approved, that it's an approved, legitimate pension plan, that it's an approved, legitimate medical and health plan, and that the training benefits that they would get are comparable as well.
Okay,
Manager, Senator Green.
But on the in the area of vesting, if to me you're comparing something that has a future with something that does not have a future, if I'm not going to get any of the long-term benefits by contributing to the union pension portion, and I'm never going to see it, why would I not want to put it in the plan I've had for a long time
and I'm
continue after the project?
And I don't disagree. What I'm suggesting is that, you know, if it's a defined contribution plan that we're talking about, and that's something that in the terms of any negotiations of a collective bargaining agreement, those are mandatory subjects of bargaining. And that's going to be there. Anybody that comes to negotiate that is going to be able to say, you know, from the employer's perspective, you know, we want this plan to be considered. And we have agreed in other collective bargaining agreements to have plans like that. But the defined contribution needs to be a legitimate plan that's set up and approved and recognized.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you. And there are other people more knowledgeable than I here to testify, but I believe retirement plans are covered by ERISA federal regulations. So what you're asking for is already covered under federal regulation, that they are a legitimate retirement plan.
If it is a legitimate retirement plan, that's correct. Okay. But I've seen some that aren't, that skirt ERISA, and that have been problematic for non-union employees working on Davis-Bacon jobs to be able to actually get the benefit that they've been promised. And that was part of the last part of my comments that I was going to read.
And I guess maybe we should change the title on this, just make it a pro-choice bill. Because I would point out to Mr. Baltami's point that with our state health benefits, we get a cafeteria style. We can pick and choose, and not everyone wants or needs the same kind of coverage. And I'm suggesting that this bill would should allow employees that choice. You mentioned the supervision, though, to make sure things are to protect the employee. Are you aware, has there been in Alaska the abuses of a union pension plan like there were nationally? And were the employees' protection there?
I've seen a letter, a sponsor statement that came from Brian Miller of Arctic Lights Electric, where he makes that claim related to the TAPs, that people were left out of getting their benefit plans, and there was class action suit. Mm-hmm. In fact, that spurned some reform in pension reform across the country that changed that. It changed a lot of 10-year vesting to 5-year vesting. And the reality is, and the suggestion that he made in his letter was that this cash went to the union, which is inaccurate. The cash never goes to the union. That would be a violation of ERISA. The cash, if there was any that they didn't get, goes into union management operated joint trust funds that have all been reformed to make sure that employees don't have that kind of abuse. And that was something that was settled 30 years ago after the construction of the TAPs, because there were people that worked under that came up from other parts around the country that never worked on it long enough to vest. And I know I'm out of the IBEW, and we had set several million dollars aside in those benefits when that class action suit came along, and then once it was all settled, those monies were distributed to those participants. Mm-hmm. We fully expected that's how it would go, and that was the result. So I am not aware of anything that goes on today under project labor agreements or any other collective bargaining agreement where employees aren't entitled to the benefits that they've earned. And again, it's a violation of ERISA. To have that happen.
I point out probably Mr. Hoffa violated ERISA from time to time too. But anyway,
okay,
moving along.
And so I interrupted you, my apologies, but I just wanted to have more specifics as you were discussing the two parts of the bill that you would change. And so you had just commented on section 1 and 1, 2, 3, and I think in wrap up that you don't have any language that you would recommend, but the concept would be that
the benefits program that would be offered that's non-union would meet the same thresholds.
Yeah, in other words, it seems to me that it's it's a little too vague, and it's not specific enough, and it doesn't, in this language here, it wouldn't necessarily, I think it would be subject to be challenged that it's not, going to do all it should do to protect employees that might choose those options.
Okay.
And then the only other part that I was going to say was on the part where three, where it says the labor representative that negotiated the PLA, technically just making a correction that it never, it's not the labor representative, it's a labor management trust fund that all those monies go to, never to the union.
Labor Management Trust Fund?
Yes.
Bundy, any comment on that part?
Well, managed trust fund managed by the union.
And the employers, I serve on the IBEW, the Alaska Electrical Pension Trust Fund. We have five union-appointed trustees. There are five employer-appointed trustees. That's the oversight board for that pension trust. So it's not the union. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. And then in wrap-up, you had another section?
Yeah, I would just say that it's apparent to me that there's several technical issues that need to be addressed. And if you pass the bill on in its present form, that it's a little flawed and that it wouldn't do what you seek to do, what the legislation does seek to do to protect the employees. So please consider amending the bill before moving it on to the next committee. And that was about the end of my testimony.
Okay, thank you. Anything, any questions? We've been joined by Senator Stevens some time ago, and gentleman testifying is Vince Beltrami from the Alaska AFL-CIO. Thank you for your comments.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next I have on the list Jeff Robinson. He's a constituent, so lift my voice.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam
Chair. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Jeff Robinson. I am the Service and Installation Division Manager for Klebs Mechanical, which is the largest full-service mechanical contractor in the state of Alaska. I've been a resident here for 21 years. This is the second time to Juneau, my first time ever testifying or being in front of a body like this, so I'm very honored to be here. Little nervous. I don't know if you guys ever saw the Western Mel Brooks movie Blazing Saddles. Gene Wilder was sitting at the table and Cleavon Little was looking at his hand and he was saying, steady as a rock, but Gene Wilder said, yeah, but I shoot with this hand. I don't know if that's appropriate to say here, but it's probably great for my benefit more than yours. Project labor agreements place an unfair financial disadvantage on workers who work on a project who have not been subject to a collective bargaining agreement prior to the project. Forcing workers to make contributions to benefit plans knowing full well that they will not receive the benefits of these contributions is not only fair, but it is unethical. My employer, Klebs Mechanical, makes contributions to benefit plans on behalf of its employees that range from $27,000 to $34,000 annually per worker. What worker can afford to make annual contributions in that amount to plans that will never benefit them, especially the pension plans? My employer would never sign a project labor agreement because of these hardships like these that it places on its workers. Unfortunately, there are many smaller Alaskan contractors who might sign an agreement on a large project like the pipeline, and that means that there are many Alaskan workers who would suffer such a hardship. Probably an example of this would be a lot of your rural workers where they're working temporarily on a project labor agreement that never get fully invested, that never see a dime of their pension money. And I can say that with the most common vehicle used by open shop contractors is the 401k, which is what my employer has. And with that money is always that employee's, that is always that worker's. If he leaves, he takes that with him. Anyway, when I first read this bill, I just kind of said, wow. I said, this is great for both sides, for union labor and for open shop merit contractors, because it gives the worker a choice. It's always been the union's assertion, their mantra, if you will, that they're only doing this for the worker. We want to do what's best for the worker. This gives the worker a choice. He can either go with the defined pension plan when he's signatory to that particular project with the union, or he can keep his own benefit plan coming in. So Senate Bill 276 is a good compromise to ensure that Alaskan workers who work on large construction projects receive the full benefit of their compensation package. I ask you to support Senate Bill 276 for all Alaskan workers.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Great job testifying. Senator Bundy.
Yeah, and relax, we don't make people shoot the prisoner themselves. I enjoyed the movie as well. A question, I've always assumed competition is often good for folks and for businesses, makes them work a little harder and a little smarter. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Baltrami had suggested that there should be a requirement that all plans remain the same, training and retirement, et cetera, et cetera. Would you suggest that, or would I be wrong in suggesting that if the bill under it, as it's currently written, an employee could take a look at your plan, take a look at the union plan, they would be somewhat different. They would have options to choose. It may put some pressure on your employer to change their plan to be more competitive, or may not, but would that competition exist in your mind?
It could. I don't see how you're going to ever get apples for apples on any type of retirement, the whole benefit package. I really don't. But I think it should be the worker's choice to evaluate both plans and decide which one they want. I mean, to say you have to make it apples for apples is going to make it so convoluted that it's going to be impossible to, in my opinion, it's going to be impossible to administer it that way.
Thank you.
Questions? Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay. Next on the list, I have Jeff Alling.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning and welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Thank you. Yeah, my name is Jeff Alling. I've been in the state for 27 years. I've owned Alcan Builders for 26 years, and we're a Fairbanks-based general contractor. We've worked all over the state of Alaska, from Barrow to Valdez, out to Nome, and up and down the Yukon River. Primarily, our work takes place in the Fairbanks area. We annually do between $5 million to $25 million worth of work. It just varies on what's going on year to year. Project labor agreements discourage bidding on non-union contractors for many reasons. One of the most significant reasons is the negative financial impact for an employer regarding pension, health, and insurance issues. Employers may have to double pay for benefits. There is a legal risk in ceasing contributions to your regular pension plan for your employees that work on a project while contributions are made on their behalf to union pension plans. Employers will most likely have to double pay for health insurance benefits, the legal risk of suspending health insurance coverage, and the risk of workers being temporarily without coverage while transitioning to another plan is substantial. Benefit contributions for different crafts that I employ can range anywhere from $13 to $18 per hour. And if you multiply that by straight time, 2,000 hours of work, and imagine making double payments, this makes a contractor non-competitive in the bidding process if they're non-union and participate in a PLA. Finally, employees who sign onto a project labor agreement and make contributions to a union pension plan subject themselves to ERISA withdrawal liability, meaning a contractor can be on the hook for any future liabilities of a union plan. AGEA requires that the licenses use Alaskan contractors to the maximum extent possible, and at the same time, it requires a PLA. These two requirements contradict each other. Senate Bill 276 is a good first step in removing one of the burdensome terms of a PLA that keep contractors from bidding on the project. I would encourage you to support the bill. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Questions, Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you. To help me understand the double payment, you have a longstanding employee
to go to work on a PLA than out of some good business practice or moral obligation. You continue that longstanding employee's benefits in your program, but then you would have to also pay an equal amount or an additional amount into the, under current law, into the union retirement plan. Is that what
correct.
You said?
Right now, for a carpenter, it breaks down as follows. We have to follow the Davis-Bacon prevailing wage program. So a carpenter's basic pay right now is $31.93 an hour. The benefit package is $17.25 an hour, which brings the total to $41.98 an hour. With workman's comp, Social Security, et cetera, that I have to put on, and it costs me approximately, at this point, $60 an hour to put a carpenter in the field under the prevailing wage program. My company, because we've been in business for so long, has got long-term employees aging anywhere between 40 to 50 years old. They have chosen to stay with our company because we provide them with a good package. We're fair to them, and they're very comfortable working with us. We have a good relationship. They have chosen not to become union members on their own fruition. If I'm forced into a PLA, I will become a non-competitive bidder because I will have to use a wage rate right now to take care of my employees under their current package and to meet the union's package. My cost per hour will be, I anticipate, at $77.25 an hour as opposed to the $60 an hour that a full union contractor could use in bidding the same project.
Thank you. Huh.
So that would be union contractors from anywhere in the country. It would give them a competitive advantage over my company.
An Alaskan company.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
So, you know, I believe that this is a good package for the worker because it gives the worker a choice. So, look, I've been with you for 20 years. You've got a great package. You know, I want to make sure that I get the biggest bang for my buck. And that's the way I intend to keep it. We just had a PLA down at Fort Greeley. And if you ever went down to look at any of the parking lots down there, there was license plates from everywhere in the United States working out of locals. We call them travelers. They were brought up by union contractors to participate.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Any further questions? We appreciate it. Okay. Dan Wayne. Oh. Online? Dan, are you there?
Yes, I am. I was on mute, but I'm here now.
Okay, it does say yes, you want to testify, or is it just questions?
I don't have anything to add, but I'm here.
Okay. Anyone else in the audience? Rebecca?
I
didn't see any name on here. Okay.
Just a couple things that I want to make a point on. My name's Rebecca Logan, and I'm the president of Associated Builders and Contractors of Alaska. And there are just, after listening to testimony, two things that I wanted to point out. Standard project labor agreements that are now crafted in Alaska already give the unions the right to audit the books of the non-union contractors who participate. So Mr. Beltrami had mentioned that was something that he thought should be a provision, but that's already there. Anytime a non-union contractor signs onto a project labor agreement, they give the union the right to audit all of their books, their benefit plans, and we wouldn't be opposed to having something that said that things were comparable. I think that when you look at the contractors who would work on a project like the pipeline, it would be comparable.
Okay.
So it wouldn't be a problem, I don't think at all.
Is that something that you could, if we held the bill between now and Tuesday, is that something that language could be discussed on that?
I think you probably could come up with something that was...
Whether it's amenable to the sponsor or not, we don't know, but
yeah.
Just give us a chance to think about it.
I think the issue that comes up, and this was my second point, is when you look at we're looking at health and welfare, training, and pension contributions. And so I think that Jeff was right when he said it would be hard to ever have apples to apples, especially
right.
in the training area. And that's one area where I think that it would be hard to do that. There's so many different ways that people train. There's the way that the unions train, and there was the way that the private sector trains. So it might be hard to do it in that arena. But, you know, there could be some broad language in regard to the health and welfare and the pension.
Yeah.
Senator Green.
Well, your training program could probably be comparable if you got as much from the state as some of the...
We choose not to. Our employers pay for their own.
But you're not saying that under a project labor agreement, after the review of a private employer's plan, the union can refuse that employee from coming on?
No.
It's just a review. It's not, they can't reject.
Well, my understanding of what Mr. Beltrami said was that he wanted to make sure they were qualified plans. And that's fair, that they're qualified under ERISA as employee benefit plans that are eligible.
And but you really want that in statute?
I'm open to suggestion.
I hate to put it in statute.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything further? Any further questions? Senator French?
Maybe for the bill's sponsor, but I'm listening to the debate today. It sounds like the real money, if you will, is involved in the pension contributions. That's where you go from $50 an hour to $67 an hour for a carpenter, for 60 to 77. You know, it's the $17 an hour for pension contributions. And so I'm just interested in whether there is, perhaps you can't do an apples to apples comparison, but a worker needs to make an informed choice. A worker should know, you know, I'm putting my money into a plan that requires me to spend 5 years before I get anything back. So you know, it requires me to vest. Or I'm putting my money into a plan that is a 401k and I'll have to direct it here or there. Or you know, my employer is going to continue to make contributions for me as I'm working in this PLA, which, you know, puts us at a competitive disadvantage. It just strikes me that, you know, we need a little more language here to make certain that a worker makes a good informed decision. I heard Mr. Beltrami say he's in favor of, you know, the bill in general, because it is a pro-worker bill. But it just sounded like there just needs to be a little more disclosure, if you will, at that moment that you make that decision that can have such huge ramifications. I mean, just on my own background, I worked for 3 years for an oil company, and they had a five-year vesting plan. Whatever I contributed to that, you know, oil company, you know, they got taken out of my paycheck every month, it's gone forever. I mean, I was a young worker. I didn't know any better. But you know, if I'd had the choice, I might have made a different one. So I think, you know, at that moment when a vested non-union worker, you know, sort of steps into a PLA world, he's got an extremely important decision to make, just as you know, sort of new union and new non-union workers have to make. I think a vested union worker is going to have a pretty easy decision to make, but there are three categories that I see that have a huge decision to make when they, you know, sign up for this provision that's on page 2, lines 20 to 30.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Yeah, I don't think the bill anticipates that a union member would opt out of the union program. I don't think that's possible, and I surely don't want the bill to even suggest that alternative. The options are only for non-union people, basically. But you're right, the more information that's available, and, you know, if you have some specific suggestions or some language, I'd be interested in hearing it, and I'll take a look at it as well.
Okay. I'll do that. Thank you.
And then my final point was that there's a lot of discussion about what can be done, and that's not the same as what will be done. And one of the things that often happens in a project labor agreement is that the terms of the agreement are struck between people, and the majority of the people who are going to be covered by that are left out of the negotiation. So that's why I think it's appropriate, when the state is in this role acting as a market participant, that they can protect those people who don't get to participate in the negotiations.
Okay, Barbara Huff, did you want to testify? Did I see you? And then you're next. I don't have your names on the list, but I'll just...
Madam Chair, I was reminded that Mr. Beltrami said the state doesn't want to get too involved in collective bargaining, and he's right in that, except that the legislature and public employee unions is deeply involved, because we have to fund the results of the bargaining. So the state is still already, I think, pretty deeply involved.
Morning.
Welcome to Senate Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify this morning. I actually came in under the guise that I would not testify, but rereading a letter where we were specifically mentioned and listening to some of the discussion here, I guess I'd behalf of the Teamsters. For the record, my name is Barbara Huff-Teknis. I'm Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959. And there was and I won't mention the particular electric company, but we were referred to in this particular letter that was sent to all of the senators. And I felt it was important to go on record here, because what we're doing is living 30 years ago. Yes, there was a class action suit that was filed. It cost us millions and millions and millions of dollars. Not out of our general fund, it came out of the pension plan. And yes, we paid. And no, it was not a cash cow. And I felt it very, very important to go on record. I mean, this happened 30 years ago. We have, as Mr. Beltrami mentioned earlier, under ERISA, there were some drastic changes in federal law as a result of these lawsuits. We spent tons of money. The Teamsters had the deepest pockets, and we were the ones that, of course, they went after first. Unfortunately, everybody else fell in the same or similar category. We negotiated a project labor agreement with the owners, anticipate that when and if there is a gas line that comes down the pike, there will be whoever those particular players are. That particular managing company, or if it's the owners or whomever it may be, of course, they will ultimately be the deciding factor on who those subs are going to be. It's not our job to negotiate. It's not our job to have a bill drafted here and come in. Let's say you have a Davis construction or a Neisser construction that gets a construction contract in Anchorage, for example. I'll use the convention center. Introduce a bill down here that says, and the unions are pushing this, so that we can designate, or by law designate, who those subcontractors are going to be on that project. Again, that goes back to that successful contractor, and they go through their own process and their selection process. What this bill is attempting to do is to piecemeal specific areas of law that are mandatory subjects of bargaining. We go through the negotiating process with whomever that particular designated employer or employers, as the case may be, on a project labor agreement, and we're very, very much aware of that. 30 years ago, there were some decisions that were made. There were folks that were impacted. Nobody talks about the health benefits that these individuals all had. They walked in. They had free prescriptions. They had free hospital care. They had everything that was given to them under our negotiated health benefit plan. Nobody talks about that. Nobody talks about the recreation centers or the medevac planes that were sent out under our union plan to take care of those workers that we represented during those particular times. And I just wanted to get that on the record. There were some very, very good things. Yes, we were taken to court. Yes, we went through that process, and we paid millions and millions and millions of dollars back. We've been there, we've done that. I think that we've moved on. We've negotiated many, many collective bargaining agreements. We represent thousands of workers around this state. We'll continue to negotiate what we believe to be very fair and reasonable negotiated collective bargaining agreements out there. That is our job. Our job is to represent. I will chime along with Mr. Beltrami on definitely, we want to make sure that the workers are protected and that they're offered, and knowingly offered, a benefit package that indeed they can survive. We're not looking at a 10-year vesting, it's a 5-year. We currently have collective bargaining agreements with employers who have pension plans under our Teamster plan. We have some that actually have employer plans. That is a decision that is made when that collective bargaining agreement is negotiated and brought back to the employees. They vote that up or down. I mean, that is part of our process. We are open. We are transparent. And I just felt it was real important to get on the record. We're not living where we were 30 years ago, and we hope that in a more positive direction we can move forward and work together through some of these issues. I know from a labor perspective, we don't want to relive and make some of the mistakes we did. We've sold our jet airplanes. We sold our hospital. We've sold our recreation centers. Now we're in the business of representing the employees, which really, truly is the job that our members pay us to do. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Thank you.
Well, some of us enjoyed the recreational club that you used to have. As a kid, it was one of the few places we could go. So we appreciate having a swimming pool. Senator Bundy.
I was just going to comment that having to sell all that pointed out that those free things did have a cost.
Okay, and so anyone else in the audience, there is someone, okay? If you just come up and put yourself on the record.
Hi, my name is Anthony Syverson. I used to work here, I did work under Davis Bacon Wages for a paving company, and I've worked for other companies too. I built a hospital in Sitka and paved Sitka. Plus, I worked with some companies out of the state, actually out of the country, that work here. Was I paying into this with those companies? I worked for commercial offshore fishing companies, Bering Sea all the way to Hawaii down and up and down the southeast. Are those some of the companies that are paying into this?
I'm sure not aware that they were under a project labor agreement, no.
It's all contractual under the certain contractors like you were in on it, your company?
I really don't understand your question.
Who's paying for this fund that's coming in? That the money for to give the workers a choice, who's paying for that? The union?
Okay, I see where you're going. What we're talking about is if you were to go to work on a contract under what's called a project labor agreement, a very specific type of contract.
Yeah.
And what the bill is proposing, what Senator Bundy is proposing, is that you would be given a choice at the outset when you sign that contract as to whether you want your contributions that you're going to pay mandatorily toward retirement and health benefits and so forth, that you'll be given a choice about where they go, whether they go directly into the union who negotiated that project labor agreement or whether they'll go into some other plan of your choosing. Up to this point, I would have to look at each employer you worked for to know where they went. But if you weren't under a project labor agreement, then the bill doesn't apply to you.
Okay, that's what I wasn't sure of. Okay, the project labor agreement. Yeah, that's what I was wondering, which contracts and which companies were paying into that. And thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for testifying.
And I'm for the employees to have a choice on this, for the workers to have a choice and maybe a better outcome in their future finances.
Nice. Thank you. Okay, anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 276 that I've overlooked? Anyone online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we will close public testimony, set the bill aside until Tuesday, and see whether any progress is made or not.
Briefities.
Briefities.